Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. My name is Joe Epstein. I'm a past president of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors. I'll be your moderator for today. It is my pleasure to welcome tonight's speaker, Dean Ornish, MD, the president and director of the Preventive Medicine Research Institute and author of multiple bestsellers, most recently the book titled The Spectrum. Dr. Dean Ornish is the founder, the president, and director of the nonprofit Preventive Medicine Research Institute, as well as a clinical professor of medicine at the University of California in San Francisco. And through his research, Dr. Ornish has demonstrated for the first time that comprehensive lifestyle changes can, in fact, reverse the progression of chronic diseases such as severe coronary heart disease and prostate cancer. Dr. Ornish's latest research also shows for the first time that choices about one's diet and lifestyle can actually change your genes, turning on preventing genes and turning off genes that promote cancer and heart disease. His institute is dedicated to proving that we have the power to live long, healthy lives without drugs and without surgery. After graduating summa cum laude from the University of Texas in Austin, where he gave his baccalaureate address, Dr. Ornish studied medicine at the Baylor College of Medicine, at Harvard Medical School, and at the Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Ornish is the author of five best-selling books, including New York Times bestsellers, Dr. Dean Ornish's Program for Reversing Heart Disease, Eat More and Weigh Less, and Love and Survival. His latest New York Times best-selling book, The Spectrum, shows that the multitude of ways that we can both be happy, be healthy, and forget about strictly regimented diet and weight loss plans, and focus on setting personal health and wellness goals that work for you. Dr. Ornish is a member of the Board of Directors of the U.S. United Nations High Commission on Refugees, the White House Commission on Complementary and Alternative Medicine Policy, and the California Academy of Medicine. Life magazine once called him one of the 50 most influential members of his generation. So please give a very warm Commonwealth Club welcome to Dr. Dean Ornish.
Well, thank you, Joe, for that kind introduction, and thanks to all of you for coming out to hear me tonight instead of hearing Nancy Pelosi, who is a good friend and who is speaking over at Dominican College. I want to share with you the work we've been doing. I'm going to just get out from behind this podium here just so I can see you better. I want to share with you the work that my colleagues and I have been doing for the last 30 years plus, where we've, in effect, shown that when we change the underlying causes of what causes us to feel sick or to suffer, that our bodies have a remarkable capacity to begin healing themselves and much more quickly than we had once realized. And in our studies, we use very high-tech, expensive, state-of-the-art measures to prove how powerful these very simple and low-tech and low-cost interventions can be. We found in our earlier studies that you could actually reverse heart disease. That was thought to have been impossible. In fact, virtually everything that we've done in the 30 years was thought at the time to be impossible. That's part of what makes it fun. I got interested in doing this when I was a medical student at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, and I was learning how to do bypass surgery with Michael DeBakey, the heart surgeon, who passed away a few months ago at the age of 99, actually about 6 weeks ago. And it was, you know, it's exciting. You cut people open, you bypass blocked arteries, and there's kind of an Aztec priest quality to the whole thing. You know, he wears a blue monogram surgical scrub suit, and everyone else wear a green one, and anyway, and exposing a beating heart, and it was pretty dramatic and exciting. But after a while, it became disheartening for me because we were literally bypassing the problem without also treating the underlying cause. And that became a guiding principle for me, that if we don't treat the cause, if we literally bypass it with, say, bypass surgery or figuratively with angioplasty or with drugs and surgery, without also treating the underlying causes, then the same problem tends to come back again. The bypasses tend to clog up. The angioplasties and the stents tend to restenose. Or we get a new set of problems or side effects, or we often have painful choices. But what we found beginning in 1977 was that if we simply stop what's causing the problem, then your body can often begin to heal. Now, we didn't know then why people got better. We just could show that they got better, and they got better much more quickly, that within a month we found most people became pain-free, even people who literally couldn't walk across the street before the light changed without getting severe pain. Within a few weeks, were essentially pain-free in almost every case. But they not only felt better, in most cases, they were better in ways we could actually measure. We found that the blood flow to the heart improved in just a month. In a later study, in a randomized trial, we found that the ability of the heart to pump blood improved significantly in just a month. In another study, we found that even severely blocked arteries that feed the heart became measurably less clogged in just a year, and there was even more reversal after 5 years than after 1 year. And I think these findings are giving many people new hope and new choices that we didn't have before. But over time, we now understand some of these mechanisms, and what we're learning is that our bodies are much more dynamic than we had once realized. And that's part of what makes these lifestyle changes sustainable. And I'll talk more about what we've learned about what really works to motivate people to make and maintain these kinds of changes in the real world. That within a few hours of making changes, your brain gets more blood flow. You think more clearly. You have more energy. You need less sleep. You just feel better. You know, as recently as a few years ago, it was thought that you only had a certain number of brain cells, and once you had a party and stayed out too late and drank too much that you lose a few thousand neurons, you know, you just never get them back. Well, it turns out that even our brains are more dynamic than we once thought, that when you exercise just walking for an hour three times a week, when you meditate, when you eat healthier, your brain can grow so many new brain neurons that within just 3 months, your brain gets measurably bigger. I mean, it's amazing. It's the kind of thing that really captures people's imagination. Certain foods actually cause new brain cells to grow. Certain substances, like some of my favorites, like chocolate and blueberries and tea, even cannabinoids found in marijuana actually increase your brain cells. I'm just the messenger here. What were we just talking about? Never mind. Alcohol in moderation increases neurogenesis, but alcohol in excess decreases it. Saturated fat and cocaine and cholesterol and amphetamines decrease your brain cells. And so we're learning that these changes are so much more dynamic. It's not about just living longer. It's about living better. So often people say things like, you know, I don't care if I live longer. I want to enjoy my life. And I say, you know what? Me too. That's why I make these changes. I mean, one of the reasons I wrote this book called The Spectrum is the rap I get is whenever I go out to dinner, people are always either apologizing for what they're eating or commenting on what I'm eating. I say, you know, it's okay. It doesn't matter. I'm not the food police. You know, whatever you want to eat is fine. And people think that the lifestyle and diet that I recommend is pretty extreme because that's what it takes to reverse disease. One of the reasons why no one had shown before that these changes could reverse heart disease or more recently prostate cancer and also diabetes, hypertension, obesity, elevated cholesterol levels, and so on, is they didn't go far enough. But that's more the pound of cure. If you're just trying to stay healthy, there's a spectrum of choices. And part of what we've learned is that, you know, people say, am I going to live longer? Is it just going to seem longer if I make these changes, you know? And that isn't the choice. If that were, you know, I can understand why people wouldn't want to do it. But because these mechanisms are so dynamic, when you make these changes, when you eat healthier, when you quit smoking, when you manage stress, when you exercise, your brain gets more blood, as I mentioned. Your skin gets more blood. And so you don't wrinkle as quickly. You don't age as fast. As opposed to when you smoke, the nicotine in cigarettes causes your arteries constrict. So in your skin, it makes you wrinkle faster. People who smoke have that kind of gray pallor. They look about 10 or 20 years older than they really are. It's because of that. In fact, Chrissy Turlington, the supermodel, has a wonderful website called smokingisugly.com because her father died of lung cancer. She wanted to say, smoking is, I mean, what sells cigarettes? They're sexy and you're beautiful if you smoke. And yet, it turns out that not only does it make you ugly, it makes you impotent. Half of guys who smoke are impotent. How sexy is that, right? One of the most effective anti-smoking ads wasn't these big billboards that say, heart disease, lung cancer, emphysema. That doesn't work well because fear is not a very good and not a very sustainable motivator. Joy is, pleasure is, fun is, ecstasy is. That's what's sustainable. Fear of dying is what most people use to try to get their friends or their patients to change. If you don't quit smoking, you're getting a heart attack. Every package of cigarettes has a warning on there. You know, smoking causes emphysema, heart attacks, all kinds of bad things. And yet still a lot of people smoke. But what the Department of Health Services did is they dressed an actor up like a Marlboro man. They made these big billboards and they had a limp cigarette hanging out of his mouth. Do you remember these? And they said impotence. It didn't say emphysema or heart attacks because that's what gets people's attention. And because nicotine makes your arteries constrict, not just in your skin or in your heart, which causes a heart attack, or in your brain, which causes a stroke, but in your sexual organs as well. It's the anti-Viagra. Viagra works because it increases blood flow. Nicotine and emotional stress, for that matter, constrict your arteries. And so these are changes that can improve the quality of our lives very quickly. You don't have to wait. You know, if it were living to be 86 instead of 85, you know, that doesn't do it for most people. You know, even when they're 85, it doesn't really motivate them. It's really about feeling better, because there's no point in giving up something that you enjoy unless you get something back that's better. And we're always making choices. I mean, how many of you have a child? Raise your hand. I'm just curious. Was that a big change in your lifestyle? Huge, right? Was it harder than you thought? Yeah, I see most of you nodding. How many of you have more than one kid? Did you forget? or were you just careless? I mean, I have a 7.5-year-old, my wife Ann and me, and it's the best thing I've ever done by orders of magnitude, and yet it's also the hardest I've ever done. And so people are not afraid to make big changes if they understand how big the benefits can be. And that's part of the value of the research that we and others are doing, because awareness is always the first step in healing. And when we connect the dots between what we do and how we feel, for better and for worse, you know, if you've ever had a big Thanksgiving pig out feast, how do you feel an hour or two later? You feel tired and sleepy, like and sluggish, like you want to take a nap, because your brain is literally getting less blood flow and less oxygen. But when you change your lifestyle, all these things get better, and they get better so quickly and becomes out of your own experience, not because some doctor or some book told you, because you can feel the difference, then it's sustainable. Fear of dying is not a sustainable motivator, because we all know we're going to die, right? I mean, I don't want to be the first to break the news to you, but the mortality rate is still 100%. It's one per person. So we've just found that efforts to try to motivate people to change out of fear, and by the way, whatever wisdom I have came from making a lot of mistakes along the way. I've been doing this a long time. I used to try to scare people into change, like most doctors, and I realized, you know, for a few weeks after someone's had a heart attack, they are fear that gets their attention. They'll do just about anything, and even then it only lasts about a month or so, and then they go back to their old ways more often than not. Why is that? Because fear is not sustainable. It's not sustainable in politics, and it's not sustainable in our personal life. I write a monthly column for Newsweek online that, if you go to newsweek.com, I just finished one today. It's called Lifestyle Change and Regime Change. You know, it's the same principles that are true in our personal lives are true in our politics as well, that fear is not sustainable. Joy is sustainable. And why is that? Because it's too scary. So, you know, it turns out that 2/3 of people who take Lipitor or other statin drugs to lower their cholesterol aren't taking them just 3 or 4 months later. And doctors say, well, you know, why should I? It's kind of like that scene from one of the Indiana Jones movies, you know, where the guy comes out and does all his kung fu and then Indiana Jones just takes out a gun and shoots him. It's like, why mess around with all this touchy-feely lifestyle stuff when you can just take a pill, right? Well, it turns out that most doctors say taking a pill is easy and everybody will do it. Changing lifestyle is impossible. Nobody can do it. Well, it turns out that taking a pill isn't so easy, because you're taking a cholesterol-lowering drug today to prevent something really bad from happening, like a heart attack that people don't want to think about, so they don't. So fear is not a sustainable motivator, because we don't want to think about the fact that we're going to die one day, so we don't. So any efforts to motivate people to change out of fear of dying or fear of preventing something really bad doesn't work. Joy of living is what works. And again, we're always making these choices. And so when you make these choices and you feel better and it comes out of your own experience, then people are willing to make different ones. And I'd ask people, I'd say, why do you smoke, or why do you overeat or drink too much or work too hard or abuse these different things that, you know, these behaviors seem so maladaptive to me? And they'd say, pardon me, they'd say, Dean, you don't get it. You don't have a clue. These behaviors are not maladaptive. They're very adaptive. They help us get through the day. And for many people, just getting through the day is more important than worrying about living a few months longer. They say things like, I've got 20 friends in this package of cigarettes, and they're always there for me, and nobody else is. You're going to take away my 20 friends? What are you going to give me? You know? Or they say, when I get depressed, a well-known food writer told me once, when I get depressed, I eat a lot of fat. It coats my nerves and numbs the pain. Or I fill that void with food, or I numb it with alcohol or other drugs, or I work too hard to distract myself from my pain. These are all more socially acceptable ways of doing it. Or I spend too much time on the internet or watching TV or playing video games. We have lots of ways of killing and numbing and distracting and bypassing pain. But you know, the pain is not the problem. The pain is the messenger. It's saying, hey, listen up, pay attention. You're not doing something that's in your best interest. And so really our work is not just about diet. It's about helping people use the experience of suffering as a doorway for transforming their lives in ways that go beyond just, you know, eating better and so on. Because that's really what it's about. It's because when people feel good, then it's sustainable. Now, we've also learned, we published a study just 6 weeks ago in a scientific journal called The Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, where we found that even on a genetic level, that these simple changes in diet and lifestyle make such a powerful difference. We took men who had biopsy-proven prostate cancer who had elected not to be treated conventionally. We'd done an earlier study in collaboration with Dr. Peter Carroll, the chair of urology here at UCSF, and the late Dr. William Fair, who was the chair of urology at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And in our earlier study a few years ago, we took men who had diagnosed biopsy-proven prostate cancer, but who had elected not to be treated conventionally for reasons unrelated to the study. And you might say, well, why in the world would someone who knows they've got prostate cancer and hasn't spread, why wouldn't you cut it out before it spreads? And yet the latest studies are showing that, in fact, just last week, a prestigious group of doctors and urologists said that if you're over 70, you shouldn't even get your PSA checked, because if you have prostate cancer, if it's not one of the more aggressive forms, you're more likely to die with prostate cancer than from it. And yet the treatments often leave many men either impotent or incontinent or both. And so, you know, people say, well, why should I go through that if there's no clear evidence it's going to help me? But we didn't get involved in those decisions, but what it enabled us to do was to have a group of men who had prostate cancer, who weren't getting treated with conventional things, divide them randomly into two groups, ask one group to make intensive changes in diet and lifestyle, and then we had a non-intervention group to compare it to. You couldn't do that with, say, breast cancer, because most women get treated right away, and then you don't know if it's the chemo or the lifestyle that's making the difference. And after a year, we found that the PSA levels, the marker for prostate cancer, went down in the group that made these changes. They went up in the group that were making more moderate changes, and those differences were highly significant. We published that in the leading peer-reviewed urology journal. We found that the tumor growth in vitro was inhibited 70% in the group that made these changes versus only 9% in the control group. And one of the interesting findings in both the heart disease studies and the prostate cancer studies was that the more people changed, the better they got across the spectrum. And it wasn't how old or how sick they were, it was how much they changed. And that's a very hopeful message, because it says, you know, people say, oh, it's all in my genes, there's not much I can do. But we found that really wasn't the primary factor. The primary factor wasn't their genes, it wasn't their age, it wasn't their disease severity, it was how much they changed their lifestyle. And the more they changed, on average, the better they got. Not every person, but on average, that's what we found. And again, that's really empowering for people. It gives many people a sense of empowerment and control and things that they can do for themselves that they didn't have before. So we did a second study, and we took also men with prostate cancer who weren't getting conventional treatments, and we biopsied them, and then we put them through this program, and we re-biopsied them again 3 months later, the program that's outlined in the Spectrum in my other books. And what we found was that over 500 genes were changed. You can't change your genes, but what you can do is change how they're expressed. In effect, upregulating or turning on the disease-preventing genes and downregulating or turning off the genes that cause heart disease, cancer, inflammation, which is often at the root of many chronic diseases, oxidative stress, and so on. Over 500 genes were in beneficial directions, and that's the first time that had been shown. And so it kind of is an antidote to that genetic nihilism that we often hear, that, it's all in my genes, there's not much I can do. Well, it turns out you can do a lot, and we're excited about these findings because of what they imply and what we can do. And the same is true for angioplasty. There was a major study that came out in the New England Journal of Medicine just last fall, and it was a randomized controlled trial of men and women who'd undergone angioplasties. And what they found was that they didn't prolong life, they didn't even prevent heart attacks. And so often, you go to the doctor, they put a catheter up your groin. They squirt x-ray dye into your arteries and say, here's this blockage here. We can put a stent in and we can fix it, or you can go home and die. What would you like to do? Well, you know, that's, you know, you're in the most vulnerable position. You say, sure, go ahead and fix it. And yet, if we really want to take an evidence-based approach, unless you're in the middle of having a heart attack, which 95% of people who get angioplasties and bypasses are not, there's really no evidence that they do much. And we spent $30 billion last year in this country on angioplasties and stents. And so, and yet, with diet and lifestyle, we can reverse these diseases. And a major study called the Interheart Study came out in The Lancet, the leading international medical journal. And they looked at 30,000 men and women in all six continents in virtually every country. And they found that virtually 95% of heart disease is completely preventable just by changing a few lifestyle factors. Today, we don't need to wait for a new breakthrough, a new drug, a new laser, something really high-tech and expensive. We just need to put into practice what we already know. So think about it. On the one hand, heart and blood vessel diseases kill more men and women, not only in this country, but now worldwide, than virtually everything else combined. And it's completely preventable for almost everybody just by making different choices in how we live and what we eat. And the conventional treatments that we spend tens of billions of dollars on don't work, and yet these simple changes can prevent or even reverse these diseases. Now, that's important because healthcare, well, first of all, there's a globalization of chronic disease that's occurring. Other countries are starting to eat like us and live like us and die like us. And in country, and it's all happening within one generation. If you go to India or China or Japan, even if you just watch the Olympics and you see the pictures of the people on the TV from China, there are a lot of overweight people there. Diabetes is epidemic in India. Heart disease is epidemic in most of these countries. It's all happened within one generation. So clearly our genes haven't changed during that time. It's our lifestyle. So we can do things differently. There's no, people can copy our mistakes instead of our problems. And so there are new companies coming out that can actually, you know, you spit into a tube, companies like Navigenics and 23andMe and others, where they can tell you what your genetic risks are. So the combination of knowing, gosh, I'm at higher risk for certain things, I can do something about it by changing my lifestyle, I might even be able to change how my genes are expressed by changing my lifestyle, is a very powerful motivator. And so the medicine of the future, really, which is really here today, is personalized medicine. It's not one size fits all. And so my book, The Spectrum, is really based on that. You know, the most common misconception people have is I only recommend one thing, it's so extreme, it's, you know, hard to follow, all those kinds of things, which turns out not to be true. But even so, you don't have to make such big changes. There's the ounce of prevention and the pound of cure. And part of what I've learned is that even the language of behavioral change has either this moralistic quality, you know, I cheated on my diet because I ate bad food, I'm a bad person, I might as well just finish the pint of ice cream because I'm a bad person, you know, all that kind of stuff. Or what I call this, if it's not this moralistic quality, it's this kind of fascist manipulative quality, you know, it's like patient compliance and willpower, just creepy words to me, you know, it's all about constraining and you're like, and as soon as I tell somebody, don't eat this and do this and don't smoke and do that, they just kind of hunch up their shoulders and they want to immediately go do the opposite. You know, it's just human nature. It goes back to the first dietary intervention that failed, you know, when God said, don't eat the apple, and that didn't work, and that was God talking, so we're not going to do better than that. Because even more than being healthy, people want to feel free and in control. And so rather than saying these are good foods and bad foods and don't eat this and do that, to say, look, you're a grown-up. Eat whatever you want. Life is to be enjoyed. I've been working with some of the big food companies to try to get them to make healthier foods because I've seen what a powerful difference these changes can make. So I'm always looking for leverage points, one of which is to change the system of reimbursement. And just 6 weeks ago, when the Medicare bill got passed, it included language that covers our program and ones like it, so it can be available to the people who most need it. And we're giving the licensing away for free in an open source way, because if we change reimbursement, we change medical practice and medical education. And so that was a leverage point. Another is, you know, writing books or writing my Newsweek column, or what I chair Google's health advisory board because that's an opportunity to reach many, many people. But I also work with some of the big food companies because I've been working at McDonald's. After 8 years, they finally took the trans fats out of their foods, which I've been counseling to do for a long time. The salads that you see there came from my work with them. And I figured, you know, even incremental change when they have 50 million customers a day is a good thing. The fruit and walnut salad was the first salad we developed. It's just apples and grapes and lettuce and walnuts. And because of that one salad, McDonald's is the biggest purchaser of apples in the world. I mean, who would have thought a few years ago? I chair PepsiCo's Health Advisory Board, which owns Pepsi, of course, but Frito-Lay and Gatorade and Aquafina and Quaker Oats and Tropicana and so on. And again, to make it not only healthier foods, which they're doing, but also to change the way people think about eating healthier, because in a way, they're in the behavioral modification business too, and they know how to market and advertise better than anyone. And so we can make it fun and sexy and hip and cool and crunchy and convenient to eat healthier and to live healthier, so to change the way people do that. And so another leverage point is trying to change on a policy level what's happening, because healthcare costs are reaching a tipping point. And 3 years ago, General Motors spends more money for healthcare for their employees than they do for steel. And Howard Schultz of Starbucks said last year they spend more money for healthcare for Starbucks employees than they do for coffee beans. At Mars, they spend more for healthcare than for sugar. And 3 years ago, Steve Bird, who's the CEO of Safeway, came to me and said, we spent 120% of our net revenues last year on healthcare for our employees. Well, you can't stay in business and spend more than you make. And they had tried the managed care approach before of limiting access to care, which again goes back to our prime directive, our reason for doing everything, which is if you treat the cause of a problem, it's a lot more effective than just trying to deal with the symptoms. And managed care, shortening hospital stays, limiting capitation, shifting to outpatient surgery, none of those really address the more fundamental causes of why people get sick. And so I said, why don't we? And so that led to a contentious strike, and it cost the company a lot of money, and everybody lost. I said, why don't we take a different approach? Let's emphasize wellness, incentivize healthy behaviors, make healthier foods available, build gyms, incentivize people to get preventive screenings and so on. And they did that. And within the first year, their healthcare costs, instead of climbing every year, they went down 11%, and they've remained flat ever since then. Because, again, these mechanisms that control our health and well-being, for better and for worse, are so dynamic, you don't have to wait. It's not like you do something today, and then years later, somebody finally saves some money. It happens in the first year. And I know early on, we met with insurance companies, and Mutual of Omaha did it. We did a demonstration project, and they found that almost 80% of people who were told they needed a bypass or angioplasty were able to safely avoid it, and they saved $30,000 per patient in the first year. And we did a second demonstration project with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Pennsylvania, Highmark, and they found compared to a match control group, they cut their costs in half in the first year and by an additional 20 to 30% in subsequent years. And so as healthcare costs, it hit the grocery business first, but it's hitting all industries now. It's a major focus of the upcoming presidential campaigns. Both Senator Obama and Senator McCain are saying we have to deal with this. Senator Obama has a much more well-developed health plan for that, but it's something that's going to be a major part of the debates, because we can't afford it. We have 49 million Americans who don't have health insurance. If we just put it, it's really disease insurance. If we just put them in the system and do bypasses and angioplasties and so on, then costs go up exponentially. Then we have these painful choices because we haven't treated the cause. We haven't addressed what the lifestyle choices that people make each day that really control whether or not we get sick to a large degree. 75% of most companies' healthcare costs are from four things: obesity, heart disease, prostate and breast cancer, and diabetes, all of which are completely preventable for most people and even reversible simply by changing diet and lifestyle. So another leverage point is writing books. And so in the spectrum, I've said, okay, let's get away from this idea of good foods and bad foods. Let's put all foods in there. But some foods are healthier for you than others. Rather than getting away from the moral aspects, just say, some foods are healthier for you than others. Does that mean you should never eat unhealthy foods? No. My personal love is chocolate. I love chocolate. That's my particular indulgence. For you, it might be something else. But what matters most is our overall way of eating and living. So if you indulge yourself one day, it doesn't mean you cheated or you got off the diet. Even the whole concept of a diet is wrong, because a diet is all about what you can't have. And what you can't have, scarcity and repression and deprivation, are not sustainable for very long. You can force yourself to go on a diet, but sooner or later, if you go on it, you're going to go off it. So this is a way of eating and living, and that makes it sustainable. So you can find, what I've done is I've categorized foods from the most healthful to the least healthful and say, figure out where you are on the spectrum, and overall, move in a healthier direction. How fast you move and how much you move is really a function of your own needs and genes and preferences. But the more you move and the more quickly you move, the better you're going to feel and the better you're going to be. And so if you're trying to reverse a chronic disease like heart disease or prostate or breast cancer, then you really do need to make bigger changes if you want to stop or reverse it. But if you're just trying to get your cholesterol down, say 50 points, you can start by making moderate changes, but moderate changes don't do much. And so what happens is you go to your doctor, your dietitian, they put you on a, you know, less red meat, more fish and chicken, 4 eggs a week kind of diet, and then you go back and a month later your cholesterol hasn't come down much. They say, I'm sorry, you failed diet, now we have to put you on Lipitor, other drugs the rest of your life. What I would say is, well, now you have a choice. You can go on those drugs or you can make bigger changes, go a little bit further. And we found on average, which we published in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 1998, a 40% average reduction in cholesterol, LDL, the bad cholesterol levels, without using drugs, simply by making bigger changes in lifestyle. And since over $15 billion were spent on Lipitor alone last year, if we're talking about bringing healthcare costs down while improving the quality, then again, we can treat the cause. And at Safeway, for example, Steve Bird has now put together a coalition of Democrats and Republicans and labor and management. It's really bringing people together because these are human issues that we all face. They're not just in the usual balkanization that we have in our culture. So they've asked me to talk for just about 30 minutes or so, which I've now done. There are a lot of things we can talk about, everything from what's the best supplement to be taking and what's the best diet to be on and high carb and low carb and all these kinds of things. But let me stop here and to say again how much I appreciate the chance to be here, and let's go ahead and get to some of the questions. Thank you.
Our thanks to Dr. Dean Ornish for his comments this evening. Dr. Ornish, as you can see, you've been dancing around all these questions I've been sorting. We have plenty of questions, and I guess there's no time like the present to just begin. First, my own question. I recently changed doctors. I mean, actually, there are several questions here that fit right into this from the audience. And my doctor recently prescribed vitamin D3 for me. There's a couple of other questions about that. It goes without saying that a baby aspirin doesn't hurt. But he prescribed 2,000 to 3,000 units a day, and he says that it'll have multiple benefits, some of which I can't mention on the air. So what is your advice?
You can. Sir? I already have.
What is your advice for those of us over 50?
Well, with respect to vitamin D3, there is an increasing number of studies showing that vitamin D is actually one of the few vitamins that is actually, when they look at it, have proven value in terms of preventing or helping to prevent some of the most common cancers like prostate and breast cancer and heart disease, as well as bone density. So that's a good thing. I personally take 3 or 4 grams a day of fish oil. My mentor, when I was at Mass General, Alex Leaf, discovered this 20 years ago. And just a small amount of fish oil a day, which provides the omega-3 fatty acids, can reduce your risk of a heart attack, sudden cardiac death, which is as bad as it sounds, can reduce that by up to 80%. So if you don't, and if that's not enough, it can reduce your risk of breast cancer in women and prostate cancer in men. It can reduce depression in kids especially. And if you take it when you're pregnant or you're nursing, because it goes through your breast milk, it can raise your child's IQ 7 to 10 points and make your kid smarter. So if you don't remember anything else, take some fish oil every day. There's just a few people who shouldn't be taking that. They tend to be people who have really bad congestive heart failure. But other than that, I think it's a really good thing for most people, and I've been recommending it for a long time. I take a good multivitamin. If you're a man or a postmenopausal woman, it's probably better to take a multivitamin that doesn't have iron in it, because iron is a powerful oxidant, and it causes cholesterol to end up in your arteries, for example. I take some calcium and magnesium, and I take some turmeric, because turmeric, which is the spice that's found in curries, curcumin and turmeric, is a powerful anti-inflammatory substance. There are actually over 100,000 substances that have anti-cancer, anti-heart disease, anti-aging properties, phytochemicals, bioflavonoids, carotenoids, retinols, isoflavones, genistein, lycopene, on and on and on. Where do you find these? You find them predominantly in fruits and vegetables and whole grains and legumes and soy products. And turmeric helps to prevent Alzheimer's, because Alzheimer's is an inflammatory process, and that runs in my family. So it's an example of a personalization, how you can find things that are really beneficial, and the only side effects, unlike most things we do, are good ones.
So, Dr. Ornish, there's a question here. You just referred to fish oil and omega-6, did you say?
Omega-3s.
Omega-3. So this question
asks the following: how bad is a long-term diet of high omega-6 and very low omega-3?
Well, again, it's not so much bad, but it's unhealthy, because omega-6s tend to promote inflammation, whereas omega-3s tend to prevent it. And most Americans, the omega-6 to omega-3 ratio is really too high, and that's one of the problems. And so what you want to do is to eat fewer omega-6s and more omega-3s, and by doing that, because it appears that chronic inflammation, kind of smoldering inflammation, is at the root of a number of chronic diseases, and so I would recommend going the opposite direction from what this person is advocating.
Well, I guess I can speak for most of us when I say, when we go to our doctor and we get our test results from blood tests, the doctor speaks to us about triglycerides and cholesterol. So here's a few questions in that vein.
No pun intended.
No pun intended, right. So, Dr. Ornish, you've said before that the typical low-fat diet profile raises triglycerides. If the cholesterol numbers on the otherwise fine are raised, are raised triglycerides by themselves a risk factor for heart disease?
Well, let me put the question in a larger context, because there's all this misinformation about low carb, high carb. You know, I debated Dr. Atkins a number of times before he died, and he was the low-carb guy, I was the low-fat guy, and it's really not like that. In fact, what I find interesting, and I wrote an essay on this for the New York Times last week. If you go to the New York Times website and go to John Tierney's blog, you'll see it. And I also wrote an essay for Time magazine about 3 or 4 years ago on a similar topic. They ended up calling it the Atkins-Ornish-South Beach Zone Diet or something like that. But it's about the convergence of dietary recommendations. You know, people are tired of these diet wars and this bickering. And it turns out that that there was an article in the New England Journal a couple of weeks ago saying that the Atkins diet was better than the low-fat or the Mediterranean diet because it raised your HDL and lowered your triglycerides. Well, the reason is because it's not so much low-fat versus low-carb. There are good carbs and bad carbs, and there are good fats and there are bad fats. And what often people, when they go on a low-fat diet, they go on a very high refined carb diet. And just to take a moment and explain what that means, there are two basic kinds of carbohydrates. There are the good carbs, which are the carbs that you find in their natural forms. Fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, soy products, whole grains are rich in fiber. And fiber has two benefits. It fills you up before you get too many calories. You can only eat so many apples, you're going to get full before you get too many calories because it's so rich in fiber. But you can consume virtually unlimited amounts of sugar, which don't fill you up. So one can of Coke has 12 to 14 teaspoons of sugar in it. So you get all these calories that don't fill you up. And the other thing that fiber does is it slows the absorption of your food. So if you drink a lot of sugared beverages or eat a lot of sugar or sweets or other things that have a lot of sugar in them, then because they're very low in fiber and high in sugar, they get absorbed from your stomach into your blood, into your intestines, into your blood very quickly. So your blood sugar spikes. Your pancreas goes, uh-oh, blood sugar is too high. It sends out insulin, which lowers your blood sugar, which is good. But the insulin also causes you to convert calories into fat, which is not good. And then over time, these repeated surges of, and then your insulin goes too, I mean, your blood sugar goes too low, because imagine pulling a pendulum to one side and then letting it go. It doesn't just stop in the middle, it goes to the other side. So your blood sugar goes too high. Your body makes insulin. It goes not back to where it started, but below where it started. So you get that kind of low blood sugar craving for that so-called carbohydrate craving. And there's a good cure for that, which is more sugar. And so it's kind of an addictive cycle. It's kind of like caffeine or cocaine or other things that people get addicted to. But when you eat a lot of high fiber foods, and Dr. Atkins and I agreed about that. But it's where you go from there. And I would love to be able to tell you that pork rinds and bacon and sausage are health foods, but they're not. It doesn't mean you should never eat them, but don't kid yourself. Where you want to go is to the good carbs, the fruits and vegetables and whole grains and so on. First of all, they have, as I mentioned earlier, hundreds of thousands of protective substances. But second, they're rich in fiber, and the fiber fills you up before you get too many calories. But also it slows the absorption, so you don't get those wide swings in blood sugar. You get more of a constant level of energy. And what happens when you get these repeated insulin surges from eating the bad carbs as your blood sugar goes back and forth is your receptors that the insulin binds to become more and more insensitive to it. It's kind of like the boy who cried wolf. It's like the receptors go, oh, God, not more insulin. And so they become less and less sensitive, and you get what's called insulin resistance, which is the precursor to diabetes, which is one of the reasons we see so much diabetes. In fact, type 2 or adult-onset diabetes, diabetics actually make more insulin. So people think they have an insulin deficiency, but it's actually they need more insulin because their body has grown more resistant to it. But when you change your lifestyle, we found over and over again that people can reduce or often get off of insulin and other diabetes drugs by eating more of the good carbs and less of the bad carbs. I mean, you can go on a low-fat diet that's very high in sugar, which is often what people do. And sugar makes your triglycerides go up. The other big misconception, which I wrote about last week and which I also wrote about in this new book, is that your body has the LDL cholesterol, which is bad, and the HDL cholesterol, which people think of as being good. And the Atkins people go on and on about how the Atkins diet is better for you than a diet like I would recommend for your heart, because it makes your good cholesterol go up and it makes your triglycerides go down. Well, it makes your triglycerides go down because you're not eating so many of the bad carbs. You can make your triglycerides go down by eating a healthy diet and not so many of the bad carbs, which is even better. The irony to all this is that we have all these studies published in the leading journals with the latest technology showing you can actually reverse heart disease, when at best, HDL and LDL are just risk factors. They're not diseases. And when you actually look at what happens to the diseases, they get better when you eat this way. They actually get worse on those few studies that have actually followed people on an Atkins diet and actually look at their heart and not just their cholesterol levels. And where it gets confusing is the HDL. Your body makes HDL. Think of HDL as the garbage trucks in your blood. So if you have a town like in Framingham, Massachusetts, where a lot of this research was done originally and where I worked one summer when I was a student, the whole town eats a pretty unhealthy diet, like most Americans. And so those people who have higher HDLs were at lower risk than those who had lower HDLs. Think of it in simple terms. If you're eating a lot of garbage and you've got more garbage trucks, then you're better at getting rid of the garbage in your blood. So that's a good thing. So that's where the idea that HDL was good and protective came from. But if you eat a stick of butter, your HDL will go up because it's like your body goes, hey, more garbage, let's make more garbage trucks to get rid of it. It's very different when you're looking at a stable population of people and say those who have more HDL are at lower risk than those who aren't. It's different when you're intervening and putting people on a different diet. If you put people on a really unhealthy diet, their HDL levels will go up. If their body can make more HDL, it will. But that doesn't mean it's good for you. And conversely, we found in our studies that the HDL levels went down, and people said, oh, your diet must not be very good because the HDL levels went down. That's bad. I said, wait a minute. Their heart disease got better. That's what we measured using quantitative arteriography, using cardiac PET scans, using radionuclide ventriculography, using SPECT thallium, and looking, they had 2.5 times fewer cardiac events, all published in JAMA, The Lancet, New England Journal, and so on. I said, that's what matters. How could it be bad? Well, the HDL goes down because it's the opposite. It's like your body goes, hey, at least teleologically, not as much garbage, don't need to make so many garbage trucks. It has a very different prognostic significance. Does that make sense? And so it's important to understand that, because so often people, you know, it's a little knowledge is a dangerous thing if they don't go into it more deeply.
Well, the person that wrote this question, and it's a follow-up question, does have a little knowledge, and so I'm going to read it. It says that I've read that only 25% of the cholesterol from food impacts our total cholesterol. Is that correct?
I don't understand the question. 25%?
25%
of the cholesterol from food impacts... Oh, well, cholesterol affects your blood cholesterol. Dietary cholesterol affects your blood cholesterol. Saturated fat affects your blood cholesterol levels even more, so you want to try to reduce both.
Okay, you were talking about food, and we have a lot of questions about food. This particular one is regarding organic food. What are your thoughts on the organic food movement?
I think organic food is great. First of all, it usually tastes better. If you can get locally grown organic food and you can afford it, I think it's the best way to eat. It's the most sustainable way to eat, both from an agricultural standpoint. You know, even to put the question in a larger context, you know, the concerns about global warming are real. It turns out that global warming is caused more by eating meat than by driving cars, because the methane that the cows produce and the deforestation that's caused by having to clear so much land to sustain these cattle farms is actually creating more carbon dioxide than the emissions from cars. It's also a much more sustainable way to eat for the planet, because it takes a lot more energy and a lot more protein to create animal protein than plant-based protein. Does that mean everybody in the world should be a vegetarian? I'm not saying that. But to the degree that people do that, there's a corresponding benefit for your own health as well as for the planet's health.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California's radio program, and tonight's guest is Dr. Dean Ornish, expert on preventive medicine, and it is about how to live a healthy lifestyle. I'm Joe Epstein. Let's talk a minute about calorie restriction. There is new research, according to this person, on the benefits of caloric restriction. What are your thoughts on the value or risk associated with calorie restriction as a way to improve one's health?
Well, the caloric restriction is the one intervention that's been clearly shown to extend life. But there are two ways of reducing calories. One way is to eat less food, and you can reduce your calories on any diet. And this both goes to caloric restriction as a way of living longer, as also as a way of losing weight. The problem is that if you just eat less food, you get fewer calories, but it's very hard to sustain that because you get hungry. It's not hard to figure out. But the other way to reduce your caloric intake is to change not only the amount of food, but also the type of food. And the book I wrote called Eat More, Weigh Less was based on the observation we had where we weren't restricting calories in the people in our heart disease studies because we didn't really care. We were mainly focusing on their heart disease, and yet we found the average person lost 24 pounds in the first year, and they kept half that weight off 5 years later, and we weren't even restricting their caloric intake. We were changing the type of food. So how do you get too many calories? Well, one way is to eat too much food. The other is to eat too much fat because fat is very dense in calories. Fat has 9 calories per gram. Protein and carbs have only 4. So when you eat less fat, you're going to get fewer calories without having to consume less food. And it's the volume of the food that fills you up, not the number of calories that you eat. And so when you eat a healthier food, when you eat mainly good carbs, which again are high in fiber and low in caloric density, you can eat whenever you're hungry, you can eat until you're full, and you're still going to lose weight, and you're going to have fewer calories in terms of living longer without having the sense of hunger and deprivation.
Well, Dr. Ornish, here's a question of counterpoint to that last one. Recent studies seem to have shown that 50% of obese people may be healthy. Should we believe them? How can this be?
Well, I don't know about obese people, but the studies have shown that some people who are overweight are also healthy, particularly if they exercise a lot. And a lot of those studies get confounded because sometimes illnesses can create wasting states that cause people to lose weight, and it's sometimes hard to separate out the two. And so, but I think it's important to distinguish between simply losing weight and also losing weight in a way that's helpful. And that's why it's important to not just say what's going to cause you to lose. I mean, one way to lose weight is just to start smoking cigarettes or go on chemotherapy or take amphetamines. There are lots of ways that are proven to help you lose weight that don't make you healthy. And so I think that's important as well.
Recent and frequent Commonwealth Club guest, Dr. Walter Bortz, you may know him, mm-hmm. has written several books, including one with the intriguing title, How to Live to be 100. He recommends daily exercise. How does exercise fit into your regimen for a healthy lifestyle, and how much exercise might be too much exercise?
Well, of course, exercise is beneficial for most people, and we need to separate health from fitness. The more you exercise, the more fit you become. But fitness and health are not always the same. Ken Cooper, a friend of mine who started the aerobics centers in Dallas, did a study which was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association a few years ago. And they thought that different levels of fitness would correspond to less mortality. The more fit you were, the more likely you'd live longer. And it turns out he was wrong. To his credit, he published this paper, and he found that if you categorize people into 5 levels of fitness, group 1 are the couch potatoes, group 5 are the marathon runners, and group 2 through 4 are in the middle, the greatest reduction in premature death goes from being a couch potato in the first group to walking 20 or 30 minutes a day. You can cut your premature death rate in half, and there's very little, if any, benefit going beyond that. And so from a health standpoint, just doing a little goes a long way. Walking 20 or 30 minutes a day. Sometimes I get annoyed when I can't find a parking space near the gym. Now I've kind of trained myself to deliberately park a little farther away or take the stairs a couple floors because it's just walking 20 or 30 minutes a day total. It doesn't even have to be all at once. Doesn't even have to be all that fast. So get a pedometer, walk a few thousand steps more a day. It can make a big difference. If you want to do more than that, great. What gets people into trouble, for the second half of your question, is when people are sedentary 6 days a week, and then they go and play full-court basketball on Sunday or shovel snow in, you know, the other parts of the country. So if you're going to do more than walking, do it on a regular basis, or you can get into trouble that way.
Well, Dr. Orners, here's an appropriate question, considering that we've just begun the Beijing Olympics. Are some forms of exercise better than others, for example, swimming versus running?
I think the most beneficial form of exercise is one that you'll enjoy. It goes back to the mantra that I mentioned earlier, that what's sustainable is pleasure and joy and fun. And if you exercise and you like it, you'll do it. If you don't like it, you won't do it. So do what you enjoy. But do it with a friend if you can, because what we're also learning is that the other real epidemic isn't just heart disease or obesity or diabetes and so on. It's loneliness and depression. If you say, what are the most commonly prescribed prescription drugs the last few years, it's the antidepressants like Prozac and Zoloft and Celexa and things of that sort. Because there's been a radical shift in our culture in the last 50 years that has been a breakdown of the social networks that used to give people a sense of connection and community. And we all know that spending time with our friends and families is fun, but we tend to think of that as like one of the luxuries of life that we do after we've done all the important stuff. And what we're learning is that that is the important stuff. That the time that we spend with our friends and family is as powerful as any other intervention, as powerful as diet, as powerful as drugs, as powerful as, in fact, maybe more so. I wrote a book called Love and Survival where I surveyed all of this, and what I found so interesting is that study after study has shown that people who are lonely and depressed are many times more likely to get sick and die prematurely than those who have a sense of love and connection and community. In part because, as I mentioned earlier, you're more likely to smoke and overeat and drink too much and abuse yourself when you're lonely as a way of getting through the day, but also through mechanisms that we don't fully understand. One study, for example, showed that in the Journal of the AMA from Radford Williams, found that 6 weeks after a heart, 6 months after a heart attack, those that were depressed, 18% were dead. Those that weren't depressed, 3% were dead. That's a six-fold difference in mortality just 6 months after a heart attack, independent of their cholesterol, their blood pressure, their smoking, and other behaviors. Now, I don't know anything in medicine that has such a powerful impact, and yet most doctors don't bother to ask our patients if they're depressed, because, you know, these days most doctors are depressed. And so if a patient starts to talk about their depression, it kind of resonates with the doctors and they change the subject and, you know, you're on to the next person. I mean, really, it's one of the reasons why more money is spent out of pocket for alternative medicine than traditional medicine, because whatever the modality, whether it's massage or acupuncture or chiropractic or whatever, what do? They spend time with you. They touch you. They talk to you. They listen to you. They ask you about what's happening in your marriage, what's happening with your kid on drugs, what's happening, you know, with your boss at work. And most, you know, if you have to see a new patient every 6 minutes under managed care, you don't have time to do all those things. And so people will pay out of pocket for it because, and when I talk to businesses, I said, you know, the need for a sense of connection and community is a powerful human need that so often goes unfulfilled. People don't have an extended family that they see regularly, often even a nuclear one. They don't have a church or synagogue they go to regularly. They don't have a neighborhood where they know their neighbors or a job that feels secure. And we pay a price for that. And again, awareness is always the first step in healing. And instead of seeing these things as the luxuries of life, we can see these as necessities. And we can say, okay, the time that I spend with my family may be the most healthy thing that I can do for myself.
So, Dr. Orners, do you think that as a society, we are addicted to prescription drugs?
I think we're addicted to lots of things, you know, prescription drugs, non-prescription drugs, the things I mentioned earlier, as ways of numbing ourselves and numbing ourselves from our pain, our loneliness, our depression, our isolation. To me, why I love doing this work is it's almost like a Trojan horse. It's like people come to our work because they want to get their cholesterol down or they want to unclog their arteries. And I remember one of the earliest patients we had was about to have a second angiogram, and somebody said, hey, Conrad, are you anxious about what your test will show? He said, well, I got interested in this because I wanted my arteries to be more open, but you know what? I'm more open now. It doesn't matter to me so much. And of course, his arteries were more open too because one affects the other. And so, you know, we're in a culture if you go back and read books like James Agee or Walker Percy or some of those books, the level of sensitivity in those books is just breathtaking to me. And, you know, we've just kind of, it's not that we're dumbed down, we're numbed down, you know, that we're not really noticing what's going on around us because it's too painful in our own lives and in what's happening in our country. And if we really kind of pay attention, it's pretty painful. And so to me, that's what's important is to be able to, you know, if you just numb the pain, it's a little like clipping the wires to a fire alarm and going back to sleep while your house burns. You've just killed the messenger. You know, change is not easy. But if you're in enough pain, suddenly the idea of change becomes, whether as an individual or as a country or as a world, if the pain gets high enough and you stop numbing it or killing it or being addicted to things that are going to distract you from it, then you say, oh, okay, well, gosh, it may be hard to change, but boy, this hurts so bad, let me give it a try. And then suddenly you make these changes, whether in your own life you find the chest pain goes away, or in our culture you find that things get better. You say, oh, okay. And suddenly I've had people say things like, having a heart attack was the best thing that ever happened to me. And you say, what, are you crazy? They say, no, that's what it took to get my attention that made these other changes that made my life so much more joyful and meaningful. I mean, we use meditation and yoga and things like that, and we call it stress management techniques. And they are stress management techniques, but they're more than that. They're powerful tools for transforming our lives, for quieting down our mind and body to experience more of an inner sense of peace and joy and well-being, and to realize that's really our natural state if we don't numb it out or if we don't distract ourselves or get addicted to things. And then when you realize it's not that you have to get all these things to make you happy, that we have that already, the paradox, you can go out in the world and accomplish even more, not have to numb yourself out from it and not get so affected by it.
So you mentioned that when you go to exercise, that it can be very stressful. For example, trying to find a parking place. I know that's an example. We've all experienced that. This questioner wants to know, when is stress good for you? Is there a good stress?
Well, the stress comes not from what we do, but how we react to what we do. You can put two people in the same job, and one will thrive in it, and one will get overcome by it. It's it's like surfing. I was in Hawaii recently, and, you know, for me, a little wave can be stressful. For someone else, they can spend a lot of money so they can go out and ride the 30- or 40-foot waves. That's fun for them. So it's not what's out there, it's what's in here that matters. Obviously, the environment plays some role. But even in a death camp in Auschwitz, people like Viktor Frankl said, how come some people survive and some people don't? It wasn't just the strongest physically. It was the people who found a sense of meaning in what they did. And so if stress isn't so much what we do, but more important is how we react to what we do, then why do some people react in ways that are destructive and why others don't? And to me, it comes back from our perceptions, and our perceptions to the extent of how we view ourselves in the world. If we see ourselves as fundamentally isolated and lonely and apart from everything rather than a part of it, and then there's the sense of, wow, I'm really lacking. I don't have enough. If only I had more whatever, more money, more power, more beauty, more accomplishments, the arena may differ. This is what people in our studies would tell us once we put them in a group and gave them permission to talk about what they were really feeling. They'd say, if only I had more whatever, then I wouldn't feel so lonely, then I wouldn't feel so stressed, then I'd be happy. Now, once you set up that view of the world, however it turns out, you're likely to feel more stressed. Until you get whatever it is you think you need, you're going to feel stressed. If you don't get it, you feel stressed. If someone else gets it and you don't, you feel really stressed, you know, and it reinforces that we live in this hostile dog-eat-dog, zero-sum game world. The more you get, the less stress for me. You better get it while you can, all that kind of stuff. And even if you get it, it's very seductive. It's like, I got it, it's mine, now I'm happy. But it doesn't last. It's not sustainable. It's like people say things like, well, now what? It's never enough. Has that ever happened to you? You know, I thought if I just got this, then I'd be happy, and it's good for like a day or two, and then it's like, well, now what? A patient once said, I can't even enjoy the view from the mountain I've climbed. I'm already looking over at the next one. You know, or so what? Big deal. It doesn't really provide the lasting meaning. And so you can keep saying, well, this didn't do it, but maybe that will. And so people say things like, I make sure I've got 12 projects going at the same time because the letdown that comes from getting something is so great and so stressful, I have to can immediately go on to the next one. But to me, there's a message there. And all of these spiritual practices, really, I studied yoga and meditation for decades with a man named Swami Satchidananda, and he looked like a Central Casting's idea of a Swami. People say, what, are you a Hindu? He'd say, no, I'm an undo. You know? In other words, these spiritual practices don't bring you peace. They don't bring you enlightenment. They don't bring you happiness. The idea is that we have that already if we just stop disturbing it. And the great paradox is that not being mindful of that, we end up running after all these things that we think are going to make us peaceful and happy and not stress. And in the process of running after them, we disturb what we could have already if we just stop doing that. And so it's one thing to talk about these things. It's another to experience them. So if you do some, whatever spiritual practice you do, meditation or yoga or prayer or whatever, after you do it for a while and you feel more peaceful, remind yourself that that sense of peace came not because you got something you thought you needed, but rather, for the moment, you didn't really need as much as you thought, which, of course, is a great source of power, both political and personal, because people only have power over you if they have something that you think you need. And the less you need, the more power you have. People say, well, if you don't do this, I'm not going to do that. You say, well, that would be nice, but it's okay. I don't really need that. So it's like, whoa, you know, and it empowers you. And I've had the good fortune to spend time with you know, lots of, not lots, but some really super powerful and famous and wealthy people. And I tell you that they are often the most unhappy and the most stressed because they can't tell. If you have $2 billion, you can't tell yourself if you just had another $3 billion, you'd be happy. You know, or if you're a household name, you can't say, if I just had more fame, I'd be happy. You know, sometimes the myth, at least you say, well, I don't have it, but if I did have it, then I'd be happy. And if you go to the end of that myth and you don't have it, then it's like really depressing. So that's part of what excites me. I got interested in doing this work out of my own pain when I was suicidally depressed when I was in college. That was my doorway. So what I'm always interested in is how we can use the experience of stress or suffering as a catalyst or as a doorway for change. Because as I mentioned earlier, change can be challenging, but if you're in enough pain, suddenly it starts to make, it becomes more interesting.
So Dr. Ornish, what is wrong with a lot of sleep? 8 hours, 9 hours, maybe 10 hours or more.
Sounds good to me. Actually, there's a real sleep deficit in this country. Many people don't get enough sleep, and it's an underlying cause. I mean, you know, when you're really tired, your fuse gets shorter. When you meditate, your fuse gets longer. So sleeping is one of the most healthy things you can do.
Concerning cancer and antioxidants, that's this question. Should a cancer patient receiving chemotherapy or radiation therapy maintain a diet rich in antioxidants, vitamins, and herbal supplements? There's quite a bit of disagreement in the medical community. The person that wrote this question states on that I am a cancer patient and I'm seeking answers.
Well, I can't give specific advice for anyone in particular, but in general, the emerging consensus is that, you know, the concern is if you take, if you eat a really healthy diet, you're feeding your tumor. Well, maybe, but what you're really doing is you're feeding your immune system, and there are a number of substances that actually promote tumor necrosis, apoptosis, where the tumor kills itself. They reduce the blood supply, the angiogenesis factors in fruits and vegetables, the ones I mentioned earlier. So in balance, and we, you know, I told you we did a study earlier with men with prostate cancer. We put them on the same healthy lifestyle program, and we found that it inhibited their tumor growth to the degree they followed it. So I'm certainly in the school that says in balance it's better to do those things, but talk to your doctor.
So maybe this person is concerned that lifestyle changes and diet changes can't always make the difference in their lives. And they write as follows, aside from the lifetime changes, lifestyle changes as well, do you recommend medications for your patients with coronary artery disease and some angina? If so,
sure. I'm not anti-drug and I'm not anti-surgery. I'm about integrating the best of everything that works. But I am about giving people a full range of choices and to say, you know, you can have a bypass, you can have an angioplasty, you can go on drugs, you can change your lifestyle or some combination, depending on how much people want to change. The whole point of the spectrum is just that, to personalize where you want to be. And then we go through the risks, the benefits, the costs, the side effects. And I say, look, it's your life. I'm only here to give you information. I'm here to serve you. It doesn't matter to me what you do. I just want to make sure you know you have the full range of choices and that we can support whatever you choose to do.
Can your theories apply to severe arthritis?
Yes, we have had a number of people with severe arthritis and moderate arthritis who showed remarkable improvements when they make these changes, both rheumatoid and osteoarthritis.
How about folic acid? Do you believe that there are benefits to your heart?
I think folic acid is particularly, it can help prevent neural tube defects if you're pregnant in kids, but also I think folic acid can be beneficial for your heart as well.
And here's a question on diabetes. What is the best way for a non-diabetic whose glucose is elevated to reduce glucose levels over the long run?
Well, there's a chapter in my book on how to do just that. And in the limit, since we only have a couple minutes left, I would refer that person. But what's interesting is there was a major study with the diabetes group that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine a few years ago, a huge study. And they found that they compared lifestyle changes, and they weren't even that big a lifestyle changes compared to what you can do, to metformin and other drugs like that. And they found that lifestyle changes actually work better. And so my advice to someone is that's a wake-up call if you don't have frank diabetes but you're glucose intolerant. And it's a bigger problem in kids too. 70% diabetes in 30-year-olds increased by 70% in the last 10 years. And so that's just a time bomb waiting to happen. It doesn't have to be that way.
Is there a connection between taking calcium supplements? Is there a relationship to prostate cancer?
There was at one time thought to be that was the case, but the later studies have found that that isn't the case.
Let's just ask one quick question about oil. You talked about fish oil. Can you describe any differences between cod liver oil and fish oil and the values to be either?
Fish oil is better.
Everybody heard that, I hope. Well, unfortunately, as you can see, Dr. Ornish, we have reached the point in our program where there is time for just one last question. And this question is going to be on tofu. Some people say that tofu is good, and some say that it is bad.
Well, it's not just tofu, it's all soy products. And the concern is that soy might interfere with thyroid hormone is one of the concerns. And there is a subset of people for whom soy, too much soy, can be a problem, but you have to eat a lot of it before it's an issue. But I drink soy milk. My 7-year-old drinks it, and we put it on the cereal. And I think in balance, if you don't drink too much of it, it can be a good substitute for animal protein. So let me just say in closing how much I appreciate the chance to be here with you today, both in person and for those listening on the radio, and that these simple choices that we make in our lives have such a powerful difference. And again, it's not all or nothing. To the degree you make those changes, you're going to look better, feel better, lose weight, gain health. So thank you for the chance to be here.
And I would like to thank our audience for all those wonderful questions, and of course our thanks to Dr. Dean Ornish, expert on preventive medicine and author of multiple bestsellers, most recently the book titled The Spectrum. We thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Joe Epstein, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.